Krishnamurti, in dialogue with Dr. Alan W. Anderson. J. Krishnamurti was born in South India and educated in England. For the past 40 years, he has been speaking in the United States, Europe, India, Australia, and other parts of the world. From the outset of his life's work, he repudiated all connections with organized religions and ideologies and said that his only concern was to set men absolutely, unconditionally free. He is the author of many books, among them The Awakening of Intelligence, The Urgency of Change, Freedom from the Known, and The Flight of the Eagle. This is one of a series of dialogues between Krishnamurti and Dr. Alan W. Anderson, who is professor of religious studies at San Diego State University, where he teaches Indian and Chinese scriptures and the oracular tradition. Dr. Anderson, a published poet, received his degree from Columbia University and the Union Theological Seminary. He has been honored with a Distinguished Teaching Award from the California State Universities.
Mr. Krishnamurti, in this series of conversations, we've been exploring the general question of the transformation of man, a transformation which, as you say, is not dependent on knowledge or time. And as I recall, we arrived at a point that was very crucial, namely the one concerned with relationship and communication. I remember one point in our conversation together that was extremely instructive for me, a point at which when you asked me a question, I began to answer it, and you interrupted me and reminded the viewers and me that the important thing here is not to finish out a theoretical construction, rather to attain to the right beginning point so that we don't go beyond where we haven't yet begun. This, as I repeat, was extremely instructive for me, and I was thinking, if it's agreeable with you, that it would be helpful today if we could begin at the point of a concern for communication and relationship, to go into that question, begin to unravel it.
Unravel it, quite. I wonder, sir, what that word communication means. To communicate implies not only verbally, but also a listening in which there is a sharing, a thinking together, not accepting to something that you or I say, but sharing together, thinking together, creating together. All that is involved in that word communicate. And in that word is implied also the art of listening. The art of listening demands a quality of attention in which there is real listening, real sense of having an insight as we go along.
Yes.
Each second, not at the end, but at the beginning.
So that we are
together,
walking together all the time. Yes, yes. Right. There's a concurrent
activity
here. Not one making a statement, the other thinking about it, and then saying, well, I agree, I don't agree, I accept, I don't accept. These are the reasons I don't accept, these are the reasons I do. But we are walking together, journeying together, along the same path.
On the same road, with the same attention, with the same intensity, at the same time. Otherwise, there is no communication.
Exactly. Exactly.
Communication implies there must be at the same level, at the same time, with the same intensity, we are walking together. We are thinking together. We are observing together. Sharing together.
Would you say that this requires an activity that underlies the speaking together, or does one come to the activity after one has started to speak together?
No, sir. Well, we're not saying what is the art of listening, aren't we?
Yes.
The art of listening implies, doesn't it, that there is not only the verbal understanding between you and me, because we're both speaking English.
Yes.
And we know the meaning of each word, more or less. And at the same time, we are sharing the thing, the problem together. Sharing the issue together.
Because, as you said, it's a matter of life and death.
If you and I are both serious, we are sharing the thing. So, in communication, there is not only a verbal communication, but there is a non-verbal communication.
Mm-hmm.
Which comes into being, or which happens when one has the art of really listening to somebody, in which there is no acceptance, no denial, or comparison, or judgment, just the act of listening.
I wonder whether I'm on the right track here. If I suggest that there's a relation that's very deep here between communication and what we call in English communion.
Communion, yes.
So if we are in communion, our chance of communicating
becomes simpler.
Right.
Now, to be in communion with each other, both of us must be serious about the same problem, at the same time, with the same passion. Otherwise, there's no communication.
Exactly.
If you're not interested in what is being said, well, you will think of something else and communication stops. So, there is a verbal communication and a non-verbal communication. They're both operating at the same time.
One doesn't precede the other.
Or follow upon the other. It is.
Yes. Yeah. They move together.
Which means that each of us, being serious, give our attention completely to the issue.
That act of seriousness that takes place then requires the utmost devoted attention.
A man who is really serious lives. Not the man who is flippant or merely wanting to be entertained. He doesn't live.
The general notion of being serious about something generally suggests either undergoing some pain something, or I'm serious about something in order to get something else. These two things, as a rule, are what persons imagine by seriousness. As a matter of fact, we often hear this expression, don't look so serious.
Yes.
Don't we?
Yes.
It's as though we fear something about the serious.
So, look, as we said yesterday, the world is in a mess.
Yes.
And it's my responsibility, living in this world as a human being who has created this mess, it's my responsibility to be serious in the resolution of this problem. I'm serious. It doesn't mean I'm long-faced, I'm miserable, unhappy, or I want something out of it. It has got to be solved. It's like going, if one has a cancer, one is serious about it. You don't play around with it.
Action in relation to this seriousness, then, is instantaneous.
Obviously.
Yes. This raises not an additional question. I don't mean to go beyond where we haven't begun in that sense. But time assumes for the serious person something very different for his undergoing than it would seem to be for the unserious person. One wouldn't have then the feeling of something being dragged out, or as we say in English, time that has to be put in.
Put in, quite.
As a matter of fact, one in this concurrent communication, in which communion is abidingly present, time as such would not in any way oppress.
No, sir. No, sir.
Am I...
Quite right. But you see, sir, I'm trying to see what it means to be serious. The intent, the urge, the feeling of total responsibility, the feeling of action, the doing, not I will do. All that is implied in that word seriousness. At least I put all those things into that word.
Could we look for a moment at one of them that,
yes,
that you put into them, responsibility. Able to be okay. Responsive.
That's right. To respond adequately.
Yes. To respond adequately.
To any challenge. The challenge now is that the world is in a mess, confusion, sorrow and every violence, all that. I'm, as a human being who has created this thing, I must respond adequately. The adequacy depends on my seriousness in that sense, on my observation of the chaos, and the responding not according to my prejudices, my inclination or tendencies or pleasures or fears, but responding to the problem, not according to my translation of the problem.
Yes, I'm just thinking, as you're speaking, about how difficult it is to communicate this to the person who is thinking that the way adequately to respond to this chaos is to have a plan for it, which one superimposes on it.
That's
exactly what we assume.
Yeah, exactly.
And if the plan doesn't work out, we blame ourselves.
Or
we change the plan. Yeah.
But we don't respond to the challenge.
No.
We respond according to our conclusion about the problem.
Exactly.
Therefore, it means really, sir, if you can explore it a little more, the observer is the observed.
Therefore, the change, if it comes, is total,
yeah,
not
right.
Partial.
Yeah.
One is no longer outside what he is operating upon.
Upon, that's right.
And what he is operating upon is not outside himself.
Because, as we said yesterday, it's very interesting if you go into it rather deeply. The world is me, I'm the world. That's not an intellectual or emotional, but a fact. Now, when I approach the problem, the chaos, the misery, the suffering, the violence, all that, I approach it with my conclusions, with my fears, with my despairs. I don't look at the problem.
Would you think it possible to put it this way, that one doesn't make room for the problem?
Yes, put it in a way.
Would that be all right?
Yes. Let's look at this. As a human being, one has created this misery, which is called the society in which we live.
Mm-hmm.
An immoral society.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Completely immoral. As a human being, one has created that. But that human being, looking at it, separates himself and says, I must do something about it. The it is me.
Mm-hmm. Some people respond to that this way. They say, well, look, if I'm truly serious, I'm truly responsible, I make this act, and there comes between me and the world this confluent relationship, which is total. All the things that are going on out there that are atrocious, let's say 2,500 miles away from where I am, don't stop. Therefore, how can I say that the whole world is me and I am the whole world? This objection comes up again and again. I'm interested to know what your reply to that would be.
Look. We are human beings irrespective of our labels. English, French, German, all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A human being living in America or in India has the problems of relationship, of suffering, of jealousy, envy, greed, ambition, imitation, conformity, and all that are our problems. Common to both of us.
Yes.
And when I say the world is me and the world, me is the world and the world I am, I see that as a reality, not as a concept.
Mm-hmm.
Now, my responsibility to the challenge to be adequate must be not in terms of what I think, but what the problem is.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I follow you, I'm sure, here. I was thinking while you were saying that, that it might have been possible to answer the question that I posed, and I'm posing the question simply because I know some persons who might very well view this, who would raise that and want to participate with us in this conversation. I wondered whether you might have said that as soon as one puts it that way, one has already divorced himself.
That's right.
From the issue. That in the practical order, that question is an interposition that simply does not have a place in the activity that you are talking about.
Yes, that's right.
This is very interesting because it means that the person must suspend his disbelief.
Or his belief.
Or his belief.
Yes. And observe the thing.
And observe the thing.
Which is not possible if the observer is different from the observed.
Now, would you explore the practical aspect of this with me for a moment? People will say, who up to this point are listening, it would seem, people at this point will say, well, yes, but I can't stop it. I think I have an intuition of what you mean, they'll say. But the minute that I open myself, or begin to open myself, all these things seem to rush in on me. What I had hoped doesn't seem to take place. If I understand you correctly, they're really not doing what they claim that they're trying to do.
That's right. So can we put this question differently? What is a human being to do confronted with this problem of suffering, chaos, all that is going on around us?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
What is he to do? He approaches it generally with a conclusion. What he should do about it.
And this conclusion is interposed between him...
The conclusion is the factor of separation.
Right.
Now, can he observe the fact of this confusion without any conclusions, without any planning, without any predetermined way of getting out of this chaos? Because his predetermined conclusions, ideas, and so on are all derived from the past. And the past is trying to resolve the problem.
Yes, yes.
And therefore he's translating it and acting according to his previous conclusions, whereas the fact demands that you look at it. The fact demands that you observe it, that you listen to it. The fact itself will have the answer. Not you don't have to bring the answer to it. I wonder if I'm making myself.
Yes, I'm listening very, very hard. I really am. I'm afraid if I'm not going beyond where I shouldn't, haven't yet begun. The next question that would naturally arise here, or perhaps you might feel when I raise the question that it's the wrong question, can one communicate in the sense that we have been unraveling this? One says, I don't know. It doesn't seem to me that I've done this. One says, I haven't done this yet. I can recognize all the things that have been described that are terrible. I don't recognize all the things that appear to be promised, without suggesting that I am imagining them or projecting them out there. Clearly, if there's to be a change, it has to be a change that's altogether radical.
Yeah.
Now, I must start.
So what do I do? There are two things involved, aren't there? First, I must learn from the problem, which means I must have a mind that has a quality of humility.
Uh-huh.
It doesn't come to it, says, I know all about it. What he knows is merely explanations, rational or irrational. He comes to the problem with rational or irrational solutions.
Uh-huh.
Therefore, he's not learning from the problem. The problem will reveal an infinite lot of things if I'm capable of looking at it and learning about it. And for that I must have a sense of humility. I'm saying, I don't know. This is a tremendous problem. Let me look at it. Let me learn about it. Not I come to it with my conclusions. Therefore I've stopped learning about the problem.
Are you suggesting that this act is a waiting on the problem to reveal itself?
That's right. Therefore, I must be capable of looking at it. I cannot look at it if I come to it with ideas, with ideations, with mentations of all very kind and conclusions. I must come to it and say, look, what is it? I must learn from it, not learn according to some professor, some psychologist, some philosopher.
That one has the capacity for this, some persons would
say. I don't give a... Sir, we are so vain.
But this doesn't mean anything for the doing that of what must be done, that there's a capacity.
No. The learning is the doing.
Exactly. Yes, yes. I wanted to make that clear because we comfort ourselves with the curious notion, if I've been following you, that we possess a possibility, and because we possess the possibility, we think that someday it will actualize itself, perhaps.
Quite.
But if I'm correct both ways, no possibility can actualize itself. And in the practical order, that never occurs. But somehow it's believed, isn't it?
I'm afraid it is.
It is believed.
So it is really quite simple. There is this misery, confusion, immense sorrow in the world, violence, all that. Human beings have created it. Human beings have built a structure of society which sustains this chaos. That's a fact. Now, I come to it, a human being comes to it, trying to resolve it according to his plan, according to his prejudices, his idiosyncrasies or knowledge. Why? Which means he has already understood the problem. Whereas the problem is always new. So I'm I must come to it afresh.
One of the things that has concerned me for many, many years as a reader, as a student, as one whose daily work involves the study of scriptures, is the recurrent statement that one comes upon, sometimes in a very dramatic form. For instance, take the prophetic ministry of Jesus, where he speaks and he says that they're hearing but they're not listening, they're observing but they're not seeing
and doing.
But then it seems that he doesn't say, in order to attain to that, do this.
The
closest he comes to it is through the analogy with the child, to have faith as a little child. Now, I don't want to talk about words here because that would be disastrous. what's meant by faith here is not something that perhaps would be profitable to go into. But the analogy with the child suggests that the child is doing something that is lost somewhere along the way in some respect. I'm sure he didn't mean that there's a perfect continuity between the adult and the child, but there's... Why is it, over the centuries, that men have said this over and over again, namely, you're not listening, you're not seeing, and then they don't point to an operation, they point to an analogy, and then some of them don't even point to an analogy. Sir, they just hold up a flower.
Sir, look, we live on words.
Mm-hmm.
Most people live on words. They don't go beyond the word. And what we are talking about is not only the word, the meaning of the word, the communication that exists in using words, but the non-verbal communication which is having an insight. That's what we're talking about all the time so far.
Yes.
That is, the mind can only have an insight if it is capable of listening.
Mm-hmm.
And you do listen when the crisis is right at your doorstep.
Now, I think I'm at a point here that is solid.
Yes.
Solid. Is it that we don't allow ourselves access to the crisis? That's all that's there continuously. It isn't a crisis that's episodic.
No. The crisis is always there.
It is right. Well, we're doing something to shut ourselves off from it, aren't we?
Or we don't know how to meet it. We don't know, either we avoid it, or we don't know how to meet it, or we are indifferent. We have become so callous.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
All these three are involved in not facing the crisis.
Mm-hmm.
Because I'm frightened. One is frightened. One says, "My Lord, I don't know how to deal with it." So one goes off to an analyst or to a priest or to picks up a book to see how it is can be translated. He becomes irresponsible.
Or sometimes people will register the disappointment that things haven't worked out. So why try something new?
Yeah, of course.
And this would be a buffer.
Yeah. Okay.
Yes.
That's what I mean. Avoidance of... There are so many ways to avoid. Clever, cunning, superficial, and very subtle. All that is involved in avoiding an issue.
Mm-hmm.
So, what we're trying to say, sir, isn't it? The observer is the past, as we said yesterday.
Yes.
The observer is trying to translate and act according to the past.
Mm-hmm.
When the crisis arises. The crisis is always new. Otherwise, it's not a crisis.
No.
A challenge must be new, is new, and always new. But he translates it according to the past.
Mm-hmm.
Now, can he look at that challenge, that crisis, without the response of the past?
May I read a sentence out of your book? I think that maybe this has a very direct relationship to what we're talking about. It's a sentence that... I have to take these things off to read. It's a sentence which arrested me when I read it. through negation, that thing which alone is the positive comes into being.
That's right.
May I read it again?
Yes, sir.
Through negation, something is done, apparently.
Oh, absolutely.
Right, right. So we're not leaving it at the point where we're saying simply words are of no consequence, therefore I will do something nonverbal, or I will say something because I never communicate with the nonverbal. It has nothing to do with it. Something must be done.
Absolutely.
There is an act. Yes.
Life is action.
Exactly.
Isn't just
now here, and I suppose I should say for our listeners and viewers that this is from The Awakening of Intelligence, I think the most recent publication of yours. And it's on page 196 in the chapter on freedom. Through negation, I take it that's a word for this
about
act.
It.
For this act. That thing which alone is the positive, the word alone came over to me with the force of something unique.
Yes, sir.
Something that's not continuous with anything else. That thing which alone is the positive comes into being. There's no temporal hiatus here, so we're back to that thing we began with in our earlier conversations about not being dependent on knowledge and time. Could we look at this negation together for a moment? I have the feeling that if I've understood this correctly, that unless this whatever it is that's called negation is not an abiding activity, then communion and communication and the relationship that we were talking about just simply can never be reached.
Sir,
is that correct?
Quite. May I put it this way? I must negate, I mean, negate not intellectually or verbally, actually negate the society in which I live. The social, the implication of immorality, which exists in society, which is on which society is built, I must negate totally that immorality. That means I live morally. In negating that, the positive is the moral. I don't
know. No, yes, no. I'm being quiet because I want to follow step by step. I don't want to go beyond where I've begun.
I negate totally the idea of success.
Yes, yes. I negate totally the idea.
Totally.
Yes.
Not only in the mundane world, not only in the sense of achievement in a world of money, position, authority. I negate that completely. And I also negate success in the so-called spiritual world.
Oh, yes, quite the temptation.
Both are the same. Only I call this spiritual and I call that physical, moral, mundane. So, in negating success, achievement, there comes an energy. Through negation, there is a tremendous energy to act totally differently, which is not in the field of success, in the field of imitation, conformity, and all that. So, through negation, I mean actual negation, not just ideal negation, through actual negation of that which is immoral, morality comes into being.
which is altogether different from trying to be moral.
That's of course. Trying to be moral is immoral.
Yes. May I try to go into this another step?
Yes.
At least it would be a step for me. There's something that I intuit here as a double aspect to this negation. I'd like very much to see whether this is concurrent with your own feeling about this. I was going to say statement, and I stopped myself. My desire for success in itself is a withholding myself from the problem.
Yes.
That we talked about. And that itself is a form of negation. I have negated access to myself. I've negated in other words, I have done violence to what it is that wishes to reveal itself.
Yes.
So I am going to negate then my negation as the observer. This I wanted to make
must
sure.
Be clear, quite right, sir. When we use the word negate, as it is generally understood, it's an act of violence.
Yes. That's what I was hoping.
It's an act
of
violence. I
on
negate.
The way taught.
Hmm?
Yes, yes.
I brush it aside.
Right.
We are using the word negate not in the violent sense, but the understanding of what success implies. The understanding of what success implies. The me we separate from you,
mm-hmm.
wanting or desiring success which will put me in a position of authority, power, prestige. So I am, in negating success, I am negating my desire to be powerful.
Mm-hmm.
Which I negate only when I've understood the whole process that's involved in achieving success. In achieving success is employed ruthlessness.
Yes.
Lack of love.
Mm-hmm.
Lack of immense consideration
mm-hmm.
for others. Lack of and sense of conformity, imitation, accepting the social structure. All that is involved and the understanding of all that, when I negate success, it is not an act of violence. On the contrary, it's an act of tremendous attention.
I've negated something in my person.
I've negated myself.
Right. I've negated myself.
The me, which is separate from you.
Exactly.
And therefore I'm negated violence which comes about when there is separation.
Would you use the term self-denial here?
Not
in the sense of how it has been received down the line.
No.
But
no.
That if there's anything to what has been stated in the past, Could a person who saw that word, self-denial, read that word in this context that you're
using? I'm afraid he wouldn't. Self-denial means sacrifice, pain, lack of understanding.
But if he heard what you're saying...
Why use another word when you have understood this thing?
Well, maybe he'd want... You'd want to communicate with someone.
I'll say it, but change the word so that we both understand the meaning of self-denial. I mean, all religions have based their action on self-denial. Mm-hmm. Sacrifice. Deny your desire. Deny you are looking at a woman, or deny you riches. Become, take a vow to poverty. You know, all the mm-hmm. vow of poverty, vow of celibacy, and so on. All this are all a kind of punishment.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
A distorting of a clear perception. If I see something clearly, the action is immediate. So deny, sir, negate implies diligence. The word, you know, diligence means giving complete attention to the fact of success. We are taking that word. Mm-hmm. Giving my whole attention to success, in that attention, the whole map of success is revealed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. With all its horrors.
With all the things involved in it. And it is only then the seeing is the doing. Then it's finished. And the mind can never revert to success. And therefore become bitter, all the things that follow.
What you're saying, I take it, is that once this happens,
it's finished.
There is no reversion.
Of course not. Take for instance, sir.
It isn't something that one has to keep up.
Of course not.
Well, fine. I'm delighted we've established that.
Now, take for instance what happened. In 1928, I happened to be the head of a tremendous organization, a religious organization. And I saw around me various religious organizations, sects, Catholic, Protestant, and I said, all trying to find truth. So I said, no organization can lead man to truth. So I dissolved it. Property and enormous business on that. I can never go back to it. When you see something as poison, you won't take it again. You see, say, by Joe, I made a mistake, I should go back and... It is, sir, it's like seeing danger. When you see danger, you never go near it again.
I hope I won't annoy you talking about words here again. But you know, so many of the things that you say cast a light on common terms which... for me, at least, illuminate them. They sound altogether different from the way they used to be heard. For instance, we say in English, don't we, practice makes perfect. Now, obviously, this this can't be the case if we mean by practice that we're repeating something.
Yeah.
But if we mean by practice... the Greek praxis, which is concerned directly with act, not repetition, but with act.
Yes,
act.
Sir.
Then to say it makes perfect doesn't refer to time at all. It's that upon the instant the act is performed, perfection is. Now, I'm sorry, but I use the word instant again. And I understand why that's awkward. But I think in our communication, the concern for the word here is one that surely is productive, because one can open himself to a word. And if one sees the word that way, then it appears that there's a whole host of phenomena which suddenly acquire a very magical significance. Not magical in the sense of enchantment, but they open a door, which when walked into, immediately situates him in the crisis in such a way that he attains to this that you call the one alone, the unique.
Yes.
Which comes into being.
Yes.
Which comes into being.
So, sir, can we now go back now or go forward to the question of freedom and responsibility in relationship? That's what we left off yesterday.
Right. Yes, and that that was quoted from the chapter on freedom.
Yes. First of all, can we go into this question of what it is to be responsible?
I should like that.
Mm-hmm. Because I think that is what we are missing in this world, and what is happening now. We don't feel responsible. We don't feel we are responsible because the people in position, in authority, politically, religiously, are responsible. We are not.
Mm-hmm.
That's a general feeling that's all over the world.
Because those over there have been delegated to do a job by me.
Mm.
Yes.
And scientists, politicians, the educational people, the religious people, they are responsible, but I know nothing about it, I just follow. That's the general attitude right through the world.
Oh, yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, yes.
Solzhenitsyn, you follow the whole thing.
Right. One feels he gets off scot-free that way, because it's the other one's fault.
Yeah, so I make myself irresponsible. Mm-hmm. By delegating responsibility to you, I become irresponsible.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas now we are saying, nobody is responsible except you. Because you are the world, and the world is you. You have created this mess. You alone can bring about clarity. Therefore, you are totally, utterly, completely responsible. And nobody else. That means you have to be a light to yourself. Not the light of a professor or an analyst or a psychologist or the light of Jesus or the light of the Buddha. You have to be a light to yourself in a world that is utterly becoming dark.
Mm-hmm.
That means you have to be responsible. Now, what does that word mean? It means really to respond totally, adequately to every challenge. You cannot possibly respond adequately if you are rooted in the past. Because the challenge is new. Otherwise, it's not a challenge. A crisis is new. Otherwise, it's not a crisis. So, if I respond to a crisis in terms of a preconceived plan, which the communists are doing, or the Catholics, or the Protestants, and so on, and so on, then they are not responding totally and adequately to the challenge.
This takes me back to something I think that's very germane In the dramatic situation of confrontation between the soldier and the Lord Krishna in the Gita, Arjuna, the general of the army, says to Krishna, "Tell me definitely what to do, and I will do it." Now, Krishna doesn't turn around and say to him in the next verse, "I'm not going to tell you what to do." But of course, at that point, he simply doesn't tell him what to do. One of the great Sanskrit scholars has pointed out that's an irresponsible reaction on the part of the teacher. But if I'm understanding you correctly, he couldn't have done otherwise.
When that man put that question, he is putting a question out of irresponsibility.
Of course, a refusal to be responsible. Exactly, a refusal to be responsible.
That's why, sir. Responsibility means total commitment.
Total commitment.
Total commitment to the challenge. Responding adequately, completely to a crisis. That the word responsibility means that. To respond. I cannot respond completely if I'm frightened. Or I cannot respond completely if I'm seeking pleasure. I cannot respond totally if my action is routine, is repetitive, is traditional, is conditioned. So to respond adequately to a challenge means the me, which is the past, must end.
And at this point, Arjuna just wants it continued right down the line.
That's what everybody wants, huh? Politically, look what's happening in this country and elsewhere. We don't feel responsible. We don't feel responsible to how we bring our children up.
I understand. I really do, I think. In our next conversation, I'd really like to continue this in terms of the phrase that we sometimes use, being responsible for my action. But that doesn't seem to be saying exactly what you're saying at all. As a matter of fact, it seems to be quite wide of the mark.
Quite
good. Let's do that.